Hello, welcome back. My guest is Dr. Eldon Taylor. We're talking about some of his earlier work, what he was researching as a criminalist. He was using subliminal technologies to help youth offenders in prisons, and he went all the way through this case that he discovered the subliminals in the Judas Priest music. And we're going to find out more about the end of that and how that was kind of gave subliminals a bad name in the beginning. And now how he's changed his entire thing to using his InnerTalk technology, which has been researched by numerous independent universities and institutions. It's been demonstrated as effective for self-development, self-help, and priming your self-talk. So we're going to find out his whole career when you come back. We'll be right back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back. I'm Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM, and my guest is Dr. Eldon Taylor, and we're talking about subliminal technologies and some of the things that he was discovering and using. We were particularly talking about the Judas Priest case back in 1984, which he was a part of. And Eldon, you were finishing up that story. I'm sorry, I gave you 10 seconds last time. I know it takes a lot longer to wrap up that story. How did you eventually finish that? I mean, how did you feel after the judgment was basically ruled that that was not, it was an isolated incident and it was a coincidence?
Oh, you know, I've never been asked that question, and that is such a powerful question. And we're on the air, and I can't use a profanity. Hosed. You know, the bottom line was there was an awful lot of money involved in this case, and you can understand that, you know, were the doors open, had CBS Judas Priest been found liable, you know, the suit would have, there would have been many more lawsuits, and it would have been a very expensive price. And so, you know, they rightfully, I suppose, from their perspective, pulled out, you know. They didn't hold back anything. They did everything that they could do to discredit anyone and everyone that was involved in that case, that stood opposition to them. And then this study I started to tell you about that was really the effect of labels on the expectation factor suddenly got picked up and called a double blind on subliminal. I mean, the study itself is so flawed that it's like, you know, they took five different companies. A message on one company might be all you. You are good. You like yourself. Now, research has shown that if you were to process that from the inside out, if it was a, you know, properly done program, the minute you say you are good, you're really talking about somebody else. So, you know, it tends to exacerbate an esteem as opposed to increase it. But then another one of the programs, they claimed that their messages were all first person. And, you know, when you looked at the difference of the messages, they were significant too. So what we had is we had five companies, and according to one study, none of which had any recoverable content on them, all commingled. And then we looked at the expectation factor by saying, you know, look, you're going to listen to a memory program. We're going to test your memory before and after, and we'll see if your memory really increases because you listened to this and you were given an esteem program that instead of a memory. And then maybe, you know, you were also told, we're going to measure your esteem, but you were given a memory program instead of an esteem. Okay?
Okay.
All right, then a pre and a post test was done, and no significant difference in memory, say, was found for those folks that were listening to a program they thought was memory, despite the fact that they reported, yeah, I think my memory has increased. And because they reported that, this was claimed to be a double-blind study on
Oh.
subliminal self-help tapes that showed there was no influence on behavior. It was all about expectation.
Big
Well,
difference. Okay.
yeah, you know, huge difference. And of course, since then, lots of studies have been run. And, you know, I've seen the field go from what is a subliminal and how do we process it, you know. And the early references to Poetzel and messages that were visual images that we vented in our sleep. And this is going back to the turn of the century, the last century. Forward to, well, okay, we do process it. There's no question about that. But, you know, the influence on behavior is questionable. To where we are today is pretty clear that there's no doubt about whether or not it influences behavior. The question is, how long does it endure?
Right.
What are the limits?
How long does it take to be effective?
Well, yes, and that too. You know, Robert Bornstein did a meta-analysis in his work as a textbook, Psychoanalytic Perspectives on Developmental Psychology, that just is so, the data is so overwhelming that for someone to say, subliminal doesn't work, it mm-hmm. doesn't influence me, they need to... You know, they need to go back to school.
Well, they need to try it.
They need to get a new textbook. Yeah.
Well, all right. So, what are you now? You do your own subliminal technology. You have your own recording equipment. You do all of that yourself now. And there's ways that you can actually teach people how to make their own subliminals as well. There was one of your recent books, The Self Hypnosis with Subliminal Technology. Actually, you could teach people how to make
right.
their own tapes, right?
Right, right.
But what types of affirmations are the best ones to use when you're using which ones are better for the mind? Which ones are more positive? Which ones help?
That's such a great question because it's the one, it's the grill in the room that nobody ever notices. Technology, how you do it, the dichotic masking and all that kind of thing, everybody gets really interested in, but that isn't what makes it work. What makes it work is the languaging that we're processing. And if we stop and say, okay, what is it we're really trying to do with this? That can help us understand the messaging aspect. What we're trying to do is change the way you talk to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Mm-hmm.
We're just trying to prime, semantically prime that stream of consciousness. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So now, if I stop for a minute and I say to myself, or you, most people, if they say to themselves something like, I'm good. I'm really a good person. They're apt to get a conscious sentry, talk back and say something like, "You really?
No, you're not.
What about?
Mm-hmm, right.
Sure. What do you mean by good?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And whenever people say to themselves, this is for me, I'm going to do that, they generally will have this negative self-talk. I think of it as ants, automatic negative thoughts. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, and everybody that I've ever spoken to knows exactly what it is because they deal with it whenever they're trying to talk themselves into doing something that's outside their comfort zone.
Oh, that's why weight loss programs don't work. Exactly. You get that canceling out voice.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's exactly right. So what we're trying to do is change how you talk to yourself so that when you do say to yourself, "I like myself, I'm good, life is wonderful," you truly believe it. It doesn't, it's not mitigated by this conscious sentry that decides to slice and dice the power of these statements.
How does that conscious sentry come into play in the first place? Where do we get that?
Well, we come into the world rather innocent. For all intent and purposes, for most of us, we cry and we're warmed and mm-hmm. we're fed and we're loved And we explore everything. We probably even get into our diapers and pick out those little brown things to see what they taste like sometimes, But then life, as Robert Bly says in his wonderful little book, A Little Book on the Human Shadow, we start hearing things like, "Johnny, you just shouldn't behave that way. Johnny, you shouldn't get angry. Oh, Johnny, don't say that. Oh, Johnny, that's envy, and envy is evil. Oh, Johnny, you should share more." And what happens is we're being told that we're not behaving according to an expectation. Indeed, the way we're being told, we begin to hide ourselves. We begin to put our authentic self, as Bly would say, away. And all these things that we're told, you know, you're skinny, you're stupid, you're fat, you're ugly, you know, and so forth. All these things that we experience, I think of as the no-don't syndrome, you know? You're not old enough, you can't do this, you won't do that, you'll never amount to anything, et cetera, and so forth, that we all hear, all of that we put into this long bag. Think of it as a duffel bag, you know? And we just start putting these hurts, these pains into this duffel bag. But there are so many of them that we accumulate over time that the bag can get rather long, and thus the term long bag, that we just kind of drag along with us. We're living in a shadow of who we really are. We have all this hurt, we have all this negativity, and we develop strategies to cope, strategies that will help us feel good about ourselves. And sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, they're defense mechanisms. And so, you know.
This is how the mind can be used for you and against you. This is how powerful the mind is.
And they become very automatic. So, I mean, I had a defense strategy at one time. I'll just share this one with you. A friend of mine who is a professor at the University of Utah, William Gillory, asked me if I wouldn't share some of the work that I was doing at the prison system with his honors class. And I said, you know, yeah, sure, I don't have any problem with that. And I asked him where they were meeting and when, and he told me they were meeting at Kingsbury Hall. Now, Kingsbury Hall seats some 1,200 people. I mean, what are you taking an honors class over to Kingsbury? I mean, that's going to be a small group of people. So I said, William, why Kingsbury Hall? He said, Black Chemists of America are in town, and I want them to attend as well. So that was like 800 or 900 of the brightest, chemists on the planet.
Wow.
And suddenly that was entirely different to me than a handful of honor student.
Mm-hmm.
My stomach went thump, and but I told him I'd do it. And Lisa, some things we do in our life, they're very embarrassing to admit. But on that given day, I drove to Kingsbury Hall. I got out of my car in the parking lot. I was trembling. I took my jacket off and took my sleeves of my white shirt, and I wrapped them around the tire, my front tire, so I had tire marks on my shirt that would support the story that I had a flat tire. I got back in my car and I drove away.
God. So you created that excuse so you didn't have to deal with that.
I was terrified. Now listen, as serendipity or what would have it, a couple of months later, if that long, an entertainer asked me to do a performance anxiety program. So I did this performance anxiety program, a custom program. Whenever we do that, what we do is we don't want anything negative in there. If you put negative affirmations in it, you tell a smoker that smoking kills.
Oh, okay.
Four and five smokers that stop restart again in under 5 years. So now what's in their head is it's going to kill me if it's not already in there. And that's critically important. I mean, I don't want to wander all over.
I know.
I have to make this point.
Yeah, because we want to get back to the affirmations, but still.
UC Davis, study carried out at UC Davis, looked at the influence of your belief on what you die of by going to China and looking at their zodiac and historical records. Because in China, there's a lot of credence given to the zodiac system. And their system tells you not just your avocation, personality, da-da-da. It tells you what you'll die of. And the data was robust. It showed that if you believe because you were born under a sign that said you would die of cardiac disease, you died of cardiac disease.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So your belief is incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you don't put anything aversive on these programs. What you do is you put a profile of the individual who would never know such a thing as performance anxiety. Okay?
Okay.
What are the thoughts that go through their mind? And that's what you create.
In the affirmations, I see.
Yeah, so I took this program. I went down. I happened to finish it on a Friday. I threw it in my car because I had reservations at a national park. And, I drove to there. I checked into my little cabin. I decided I better listen to it before I ship it off on Monday. So I put it on the player. I started listening to it. I sat down on the bed. And, I was going through some paperwork. I fell asleep. Had a dream. In the dream, it was a real live revivification of an experience I had when I was a child. I wanted to be a singer. I was going to be the next Wayne Newton. I would learn all these songs. Well, I learned this song, Vial con Dios, and I sang it to everybody, everywhere I went. Well, we were at a family reunion up in Wyoming. My mother's side of the family, very white collar. My father's side, very blue collar. I mean, you had judges in the white collar and business people, and you got loggers and miners in the blue collar, and they didn't always get along.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
I can
so
imagine.
There's about to be this quarrel, and my mother sat me out in the middle of the floor and said, "My son sings," or something like that. My voice broke up, tears in my eyes. I ran out of that room, and the minute that dream came in, I woke. I sat straight up. My mother had crossed over by then. I looked up, hey, thanks, Mom, because I realized that was my fear.
That was the origin.
Yeah, unconsciously, my defense mechanism had said, that's it. You're not going to be a singer. You're not getting up in front of anybody like that again. You're never going to feel that humiliation ever again.
Right.
Well, that's a defense strategy, and these strategies operate in order to work and work properly. We can't be aware of them, so they operate unconsciously.
They hide in
the unconscious. So when we create the affirmations, we have to be aware that, what we want is this profile that is mutually exclusive to whatever the issue is that we're dealing with, like performance anxiety, and it needs to be all positive, short, easy sentences to understand, because you don't want this process called subconscious cerebration, where I give you an affirmation as a case in point to reduce your smoking. So I say, okay, look, you want to cut your smoking from 2 packs a day down to 1.5 packs. Here's your affirmation. I find 30 cigarettes a day more than enough for me. Well, the problem with that affirmation is that the mind tumbles these sentences, and they'll reconstruct it. And you can take that affirmation, and it suddenly becomes, I find more than 30 cigarettes a day good enough for me.
I find smoking is good enough for me. Yeah,
right.
I could go all
so
through there.
They
yeah.
need to be the short, and they need to be first person, and they need to be, again, mutually exclusive affirmations, all positive, mutually exclusive to the situation you want to correct.
One of the listeners was asking specifically about weight loss and what you could say to yourself about weight loss. Would you go after, is loss a negative word?
Well, it can be. It depends, again, on the context. But, when you really look at the profile of an individual who weight is not an issue to, never would be an issue to, you don't have to say you're going to lose weight, do
right,
you?
Right.
In fact, my favorite affirmation on that, and everybody that uses our program, I hear this from them all the time, the favorite one is, I love water. I drink water. I drink lots of water.
Huh.
Water fills me. And I'll tell you what, I've heard over and over again from people, now that I've read the affirmations, I understand why I like water so much.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, these are very powerful technologies that work with the unconscious mind, and we're going to explore more of these when we come back with Dr. Eldon Taylor and learn more about the wonderful boundaries of the mind and how that can work for you and it can work against you. We will be right back with Dr. Eldon Taylor. I'm Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back. My guest is Dr. Eldon Taylor. We're going to be coming back with him in just a few minutes, talking about his history, his great storytelling, and some of the new techniques that he's teaching in his latest book called Choices and Illusions. We're going to be talking about some of our four selves refers to four selves that we have and the split personalities that we all have, which is going to be really fascinating. Also, if you want to contact me, I've hosted Coast to Coast before. I love hearing from you the last time I was on air. So feel free to email me your comments or questions at news@theawareshow.com. That's NEWS@theawareshow.com. That's listed on the homepage there of the Coast to Coast website. And you can just link right there and you can send me a note, say hi. And that's also where the Coast Insider is located. The Coast Insider's, it's for fans of all things curious and unexplained. And you can get an all access pass to all the Coast to Coast AM content, current events, conspiracy theories, paranormal, alien abduction, all sorts of great, great content is on there. So you can link to that by going to coasttocoastam.com/Coast Insider. So we will be back with more information from Dr. Eldon Taylor in just a minute. Welcome back. This is Lisa Garr. My guest is Dr. Eldon Taylor. And so, Eldon, you have a new book out called Choices and Illusions, and you refer to four selves in that book. What do you mean by the four selves that we all have?
Well, actually, it's a schematization. I think that Skinner initially developed, but what we're looking at is how we divide our view of ourself. You know, we of course have our actual self, and for most people, they believe that they know who they are and what that actual self is. And this actual self is, you know, it's the person that's aware of everything we put in that long bag. It's the person that is ashamed of some of the things that they may have done in the past, that has secrets they don't want to tell anyone. But I want to hold right there for a second before we go to the next three, because it's also critically important to understand you really don't know your actual self.
Mm.
This actual self that we schematize right here, this is the self you think you know. Your real self is that part of you that makes your decisions before the conscious mind is aware of what you're going to do. I mean, years ago, Benjamin Libet, utilizing a multicranial EEG, observed cortical lobe potential, the P300 wave, coming from an area in the brain known to be in the unconscious, and it preceded all conscious thought activity. So this discovery, you know, triggered a lot of conversation about free will. Is there any such thing as free will? If indeed we are given what we're going to do by our unconscious. Now, since Libet's work, technology's gone a long way. Today, using functional magnetic resonance imaging, we watch the brain lifetime when it makes choices, when it does anything. And an fMRI technician can, by watching your brain, know what you're going to do 6 to 10 seconds before you know.
Wow.
Now, you know, for any person, that should give great pause.
Mm-hmm.
6 seconds is a long time.
Yes.
The technician has already written down what my choice is going to be before I even know what that choice is. How is that possible?
Yeah, somewhere in the subconscious.
I have a good friend in Hilo, Hawaii. He's a neurosurgeon, and he says, you know, this is John Turner, and he says to me, Eldon, there is no such thing as free will because everything comes out of the unconscious so quickly that the conscious doesn't have an opportunity to change that. The fact of the matter is we're just living in a predestined world.
So if
now,
you really
I don't believe that. I don't believe that for a minute, but I do know this. He's absolutely right that the information coming out of my unconscious is doing my living for me.
But you believe different. You believe we can actually choose new thoughts.
You can change the content in that Well, analogically speaking, in that biocomputer, you can change the content, which leads to the decisions, the choices that you make. You can rewrite that. Yes, I do. But okay, back to your point.
Okay.
We have our actual self.
Mm-hmm, the first.
We fool ourselves with that one, but okay. We have our ideal self. Now, you know, the ideal self is that self that, well, you know, in a perfect world, this is who we would be. It's often a construct that's built out of our culture. It's the self that would, you know, live a life without error of any kind. Of course, the problem with that is if there were such a thing, there'd be absolutely no room for growth either. So I'm not sure, you know, what life would be like, but okay, that's the notion. And then we have our ought-to-be self. Now, that ought-to-be self is the self that's full of all the learned shoulds and oughts. You know, we're really, our maturation process, our entire enculturation. Well, I tell a story that I think illustrates this point the best possible.
Okay.
And it's the story of the chicken and the eagle.
Mm.
You know, we have a story of a chick or of an eagle that falls from its nest when it's very young, and you know, it manages to pull itself along a bit, and it's just about to perish when along comes a mother hen, and this hen takes it back to the chicken house and raises it. So we have an eagle that grows up in a chicken yard.
Thinking it's a chicken. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and of course, you know, it like a duckling imprinted by chickens or a chicken imprinted by ducklings, imprinted is the word that's used in behavioral science,
mm-hmm.
we copy the behavior from which we are raised. I mean, we indeed have mirror neurons. And if I suggest something to you, your mind can see that performance in your head. And we're very likely to copy someone. I mean, that's what neuro-linguistic programming is all about.
Yep.
So the bottom line is we have this eagle. It's in the chicken yard. And, you know, well, it's not the best egg layer, but boy, can it dig holes. So on those hot days when the chickens just want a hole to get down in and stay cool, well, our female eagle is out there just digging these really good holes, okay? and kind of like a human being, you know, we don't do everything perfectly, but we find ways and things that we can do so that we fit in. And that's what our eagle does. Well, along comes one day this male eagle who happens to fly over the chicken coop, looks down there, and sees this beautiful eagle in a chicken coop, in a chicken yard, right? Well, what is she doing in a chicken yard? So he starts down. I mean, he has got to ask her about this. And his shadow is detected, and all the chickens, including our eagle, run to the chicken house. But the male eagle is patient, so he waits, you know, a couple of days, and finally he can seize opportunity to swoop down, cut off her retreat, and find out what she's doing in this chicken yard. And down he comes, and he cuts her off. All the other chickens, they get into the chicken house. Here's our female eagle, she's just trembling, and you know. And the male eagle says to her, "What are you doing in this chicken yard?"
Uh-huh.
And she says, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, look at yourself. You're an eagle. You're not a chicken. You don't belong in this chicken yard. Do you know what you can do? Let me tell you what I have seen, the heights I have soared. You, what it's like to be an eagle." And as he explains to her her potential, just everything that's within her that she could do, it just frightens her all the more.
Mm-hmm.
But she's a smart eagle. So she says to the male eagle, she said, "Well, now, wait a minute. If I'm an eagle, then you're not really going to hurt me." And he says, "Of course not." And she said, "Well, if that's the case, you would step out of the way so I could, you know, get to the chicken house if I wanted to, as opposed to being feeling like I'm captured and cornered. He said, sure. And he steps aside. Off she goes into that chicken house. There she tells the rooster and all the chickens how she outsmarted that eagle. And they all tell her how smart and wise she was to do that. Now, if you take this story and you just transpose it to the human condition, most people have a tremendous potential that is totally untapped within them. They're not living up to everything that they potentially could enjoy in life. But they have come to believe that there are limitations, and their lot has these, you know, various limitations. And if they were to dare to say, you know, I think I'm going to change my job and do this, or, you know, I'm going to go back to school and study this, the chickens around them are apt to say, oh, I don't think that's a good idea.
Right, that's not safe. You know, come back to the roost.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother used to say, birds of a feather flock together. The fact of the matter is we tend to gather around us people that are of our own ilk, and they tend sometimes to be our greatest obstacles when it comes to
holding us to being the same
potential.
Yeah,
correct.
And keeping us to being the same. So the fourth self is the there was the actual self, the ideal.
Oh yeah, and I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Keep me on point. And the fourth self, the final, is our desired self. You know.
Well, it brought you to that story. Yeah.
And and our, you know, our desired self is, of course, who we want to be. It's all that potential. And you know, the bottom line is, for most of us, the desired self is something that we set in abeyance for some other time because we're too busy in our lives to, you know, become the architects of them. Friedrich Nietzsche, who I don't hold, I mean, he's a brilliant person and a great writer, but I just disagree with his idea about the divine and so forth.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But nevertheless, you know, he wrote an essay called Twilight. And in this essay, he said, why is it we don't sit down and write out the characteristics that we would like to be? You know, I want to be humble. I want to be honest. I want to be intelligent. Mm-hmm. I want to be, you know, affable. You know, why don't we write out all these characteristics and then just go be them? Now, if you think about that, Nietzsche's writing this at a time when, well, when I went to school, which was a lot, you know, not near as far back as Nietzsche, I was told things like, you know, IQ is fixed. Personality is fixed. It forms ages, you know, 4 to 6, somewhere in that neighborhood, and then it doesn't change. Brain cells begin to die in your 30s, and they just don't replace themselves. And on and on. And I'm going to tell you what, every single one of those statements is false to fact.
Really?
Indeed, there's such neuroplasticity in the brain today. There are simple exercises. There's one meditation I could share with you if we get time before the show's over that, you know, you can do in 12 minutes a day for 30 days, and it's a secular meditation. And the data, the hard data shows that it rewires the brain, how you process information. It improves cognitive, enhances cognitive abilities, memory, verbal skills, et cetera.
Wow.
And you know, it fundamentally adds gray matter to the brain.
Really?
So it's an incredible, simple thing. But yeah, the neuroplasticity is unreal. Where I was going with this point was this. We all have the ability to sit down and write out who it is that we want to be.
Yeah.
And today, science will tell you that the best thing you can do to improve your life is change your personality. So why don't we sit down and say, okay, this is who I want to be, and become the architect of our own lives, as opposed to accept this chicken yard training, this chicken yard background? mean, there's a very famous study. A group of scientists placed five monkeys in a cage, and in the middle, a ladder with the bananas on the top. Okay?
Okay.
Every time a monkey went up the ladder, the scientists soaked the rest of the monkeys with cold water. After a while, every time a monkey went up the ladder, the others beat that monkey up.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
After some time, there wasn't any monkeys that dared to go up the ladder.
Right.
So then the scientists began to take monkeys out and substitute another monkey. So they remove a monkey
mm-hmm.
and put a new monkey in. Well, that new monkey would see the bananas start up that ladder and get the beat out of him.
Right. Get the trained
All
behavior.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, as soon as this monkey has learned, they pull out another monkey and they put in a new monkey. Pretty quick, we have five monkeys in a cage. Not one of them has ever been soaked with cold water. But if one of them goes up that ladder, they gets the whoop beat out of him.
Mm-hmm.
So we have five monkeys doing something that they have no reason to do.
To do.
No understanding of why they even do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, this is often a study that people use to illustrate some of the craziness that goes on in businesses and organizations, but it goes on in individual lives, too. We find ourselves very often doing things that have always been done in a certain way.
And
we
not
don't
look
really
at,
even know why.
Right, no actual reasons why.
Yeah.
I'm interested. I mean, I love the fact that there are so many new studies that are being funded towards brain research and towards neuroplasticity and all the great, you know, the magazines that have been coming out recently about the mind and the brain. Nat Geo came out with a cover story, I think, The Scientific Brain a couple of months ago. Time Magazine recently came out with the same type of. There's so much neuroscientific research being done these days. It's fascinating to me, and I think it's helping a lot because we all have that one thing in common. We all have a brain. We all have a mind, and we're learning, and as you have been for the past 30 years, learning how we can actually stretch that mind to reach to places where we didn't even know that we could go and break outside of those boundaries of the mind. As I said earlier, they can work for you and against you. They can keep you safe, but they can also keep you too self-contained so that we never want to grow whatsoever. And if you ever want to get out of that cultural meme that you were raised with and create something new for your, you know, to affect future generations, that's also another great way to be able to do that. So I'm just curious about the fact that IQ is not fixed, and to figure out how to get into that, the meditation that you said, they could literally shift the neuroplasticity. I want to learn about that as well.
Cool.
But what we're going to do is we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're also going to be taking phone calls so people can feel free to ask Eldon Taylor questions about any of the topics we've discussed here. A lot of questions coming in about the Judas Priest case. And we were also talking a lot about how to reprogram your mind to be more positive. A couple of people asking about the weight loss, smoking, and also focus and memory. So we have a wide range of topics here to be able to cover when we come back with callers. And then we can also encourage you're encouraging us to have split personalities. It's okay, right, Eldon?
Well, no, not a split personality, but a truly integrated one. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these four cells, let's integrate them. Let's get authentic. Let's, we can talk about that when we come back.
Living an authentic life through integrating all of your actual self, ideal self, ought to be self, and desired self. Great. All right. Thanks so much. We will be right back with Dr. Eldon Taylor. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.